Well, hello and welcome to the Theotivity Podcast. My name is Thaddeus and I'm glad that you've joined me for today's episode. Today's episode is a pretty important one and a bit of a somber or maybe sober one. We're going to be dealing with the topic of abortion and particularly looking at the life and influence of one of Planned Parenthood's founder, Margaret Sanger. Now, abortion is one of the evilest stains on our modern world. According to the World Health Organization, roughly 73 million induced abortions occur worldwide each year, with 61% of all unintended pregnancies and 29% of all pregnancies in general ending with an abortion. Think about that. That's more than one in four, right? If you think through that globally, when you look around or are considering a group of your peers, and there are at least four of you, that means that there should have been another person there who's missing but has been snuffed out by abortion. The current generation is missing about a quarter of its population due to this culture of death. That's children made in the image of God who could have grown up to be doctors, lawyers, scientists, artists, business people, or people who may have changed the world or invented a new technology to benefit mankind or cure diseases. Each new life is bristling with unknown potential and is a gift from God. Statistically, in Canada, 15.2 women out of every 1,000 women aged 15 to 44, so of birthing age, will have an abortion. And in the US, it's even worse. It's 20.8 women. And in Russia, it's the worst in the world, which is 53.7 women who will choose to murder their baby in the womb. And yes, that is the correct term, murder. That is what the premeditated, unjustified taking of innocent life is called, murder. And while there may be different levels of culpability in regards to the murder of the child in the womb, like the difference between, you know, the assassin who carries out the murder and the one who's just an accomplice to the murder, that's the way, though, that we should be framing this discussion. And I'm going to get into that a little bit more in this episode. There's a difference in terms of people's levels of understanding of what they're doing, for sure, and we need to factor that in. However, too often, euphemisms are used to try to soften the blow or obscure the truth of this dark matter. And we call abortion healthcare, for example. But abortion is healthcare about as much as a bullet to the head is a cure for a migraine. And too often, we want to skirt the issue to protect people's feelings, particularly with the sins of women. The modern church is too often afraid to speak plainly to confront them and call them to repentance. But women sin as well. And women are also affected by the fall and are capable of much evil. However, our hashtag MeToo culture tends to make women out to be perpetually innocent and incapable of evil acts. But as we'll see in this episode, this is not true. And this is not me trying to villainize women. Far be it from that, right? But only to say that we are all fallen in Adam. And only when we correctly diagnose the issue can we hope to make proper and appropriate prescriptions. And only when we understand that abortion is murder can we hope to think rightly about the legal questions and also about Christ's offer of amazing and undeserved gift of grace for even murderers. And it is against that darkness, the true darkness of abortion, that the light of the gospel can and does shine its brightest, offering true hope and not just false platitudes to people who are lost and in need of reconciliation with God. So in this episode, we'll be taking a look at the beginnings of the modern abortion movement by looking at one of its key founders, Margaret Sanger, abortion's killer angel. The Theotivity Podcast. Theotivity is the place where theology and creativity come together. Here you'll find audio narration of articles, episodes exploring the faith, culture, the arts and media, systematic theology, apologetics, guest interviews with Christian thinkers, creatives, pastors, theologians, and much more. At theotivity.com, you'll find articles and resources to help you grow in your faith, as well as a portfolio of creative works. Like, share, and subscribe to stay up to date on the latest content. Now, before we jump in, let's clear up some things about the abortion debate. Many people who advocate for the woman's right to choose to murder, I usually bring up the situation of rape. What about a woman who was raped? Should she have to suffer to bring a baby to term and to deliver it and then be reminded of her rapist every time she looks at that baby? Well, aside from the fact that committing another injustice never accomplishes actual justice, let's take a look at the actual statistics. In the US, 2004 Guttmacher survey showed that 25% of women having an abortion were simply doing so because they weren't ready to have a child. 23% were because they said they couldn't afford a child. 19% said that they were having they were done having children. And 8% didn't want to be single moms. 7% said that they didn't think they were mature enough to raise a child. 4% didn't want to interfere with their education or career. And another 4% had health problems. And 3% claimed health problems with the baby in the womb. Now, less than 0.5% were victims of rape. Right? That's less than a percentage. So these pro-choice activists want to make a rule out of a very small exception of cases, less than 0.5%. And these numbers hold true. For example, in Florida, right, in 2020, only 0.16% of abortions were in a case of rape or incest. So we're dealing with a very minority of cases, and the majority of abortions are done for reasons of convenience. Now, the inconsistency of the pro-abortion side can be plainly shown at this point. Because if one were to suggest that, well, okay, only then cases of rape and incest should be considered legal for abortions, or the abortion should only be allowed in those cases, all the pro-choice side would never concede that point, right? And they would never give in to that argument, because that's not actually their goal. That's just a canard. That's a distraction technique to get you away from the real point, right? That was a distraction argument to throw us off. Really, when it comes down to it, they want the right to murder their babies because they're sinful and they don't want to deal with the consequences of their actions. The majority of pregnancies are not because of rape. It's because of people who had sex and are pregnant. And that's the mechanism that brings babies, right? We know this. This is not new information, right? It's not like we don't know how women get pregnant. It's simply the reason is they don't want to face the consequences of their actions. And the solution to the majority of unwanted pregnancies is not complicated either. It's just undesirable for those who love their sin. Now, I know that's some hard words, right? But sometimes truth is hard, and we must face this issue truthfully. Abortion is modern day child sacrifice. Just as the ancient pagans sacrificed their children to evil gods like Molech for the sake of prosperity, abundant crops, and good fortune, modern civilized pagans sacrifice their children for the sake of their college education, climbing the corporate ladder, and keeping that bikini body. Even though our methods have become more hidden in the sterile environment of abortion clinics, the sacrifice of the innocent still cries out. We look back on ancient cultures that practice human sacrifice and we think, how brutal, how savage, right? Yet when we look at the actual procedure for late-term surgical abortions, are we really much different today? Are we much different from when an abortion doctor takes a sofa clamp or forceps and dismembers the live baby limb from limb while it writhes in agony? I don't think so. And if you want to get an animated look at what an abortion actually is, check out the videos from Live Action or the animated short The Procedure by Choice42. Those are really good, again, animated videos, so it's not actual footage of it, but it gives you a good and sober depiction of what actually happens. Just earlier this year, actually, on March 25th of 2022, videos, and I've got links there in the article associated with this episode. And I'll just give a warning, there's some graphic content there, right? But there were videos of containers holding the dismembered bodies of several babies that were discovered at an abortion clinic in Washington, D.C. And many of them were viable and had injuries which showed evidence of a traumatic death. Pro-life activists are asking for investigations as to whether these were actual abortions or actually infanticides. And add to that the known history of child sex abuse and sex trafficking cover-ups at Planned Parenthood clinics. Again, I have links for that. In the US, and I think you'll start to see and to understand why I said that abortion is the most heinous and wretched stain on our modern societies. It is a testimony, actually, when you think about it, when you consider just the horrors and the evil of abortion, it's actually a testimony to God's amazing patience and long-suffering that he's not obliterated our civilizations for such gross sins, when he has literally wiped out entire cities in the Bible for similar injustices. Now, in this episode, we're going to focus in on Margaret Sanger, because I think it's important for us to understand the history behind this. It'll help frame today's situation a little bit more. Now, our minds are boggled to understand how we could come to such a moment of evil today, right? In this episode, we're going to explore some of the roots of the abortion industry by examining the life of its main figure, the woman who's credited as the founder of Planned Parenthood, which is one of the largest abortion providers in the world, right? Margaret Sanger. And she has been praised by many on the left as a patron saint of feminism and women's rights. Yet her actual story is actually quite dark. And much of the material for this episode is actually taken from the book Killer Angel, a biography of Planned Parenthood's Margaret Sanger by George Grant. So if you want, you can check out that book. Again, link will be in the description. And citations that I give here are from that book. Okay. Now, when we hear names like Joseph Stalin or Adolf Hitler, their barbarism and evil are synonymous with their infamy. Yet for some reason, Margaret Sanger has escaped such a fate, for even though her crimes against humanity are no less heinous than even the most bloody butchers of history, even though she identified herself with Stalin's Sobranistic collectivism and with Hitler's eugenic racism and with Mussolini's agathistic fascism, her followers and minions have somehow managed to sanitize her name today. However, we cannot divorce her private character from her public life and accomplishments. The fruit springs up from the root. Sin doesn't just happen. Sin is sin, and Jesus says that it comes out of the heart. Margaret Sanger is the founder of Planned Parenthood, one of, if not the largest abortion provider in the world, a multi-billion dollar corporation with programs in over 130 nations. In the US alone, it has over 20,000 staff and volunteers spread out over its 900 plus clinics in virtually every metropolitan city across the US. And in 1992, it had earnings of over $23 million with over $190 million in cash reserves and over $108 million in capital assets. That was back in 92, right? With a combined annual budget of over $1 billion, Planned Parenthood is one of the most profitable nonprofit organizations in history. And those numbers are even higher today. Now let's start with a little bit of a biography on Margaret Sanger. She was born on September 14th, 1879 in upstate New York. And Sanger was the sixth of 11 children. Her father was an Irish Catholic immigrant who was hardened and embittered after military service, where he committed and saw inhumane acts from which he never really fully recovered. He was in and out of manual labor jobs, either unwilling or unable to provide properly for his large family. And he would regularly beat his sons to make men of them, quote unquote, and treated his wife and daughters like slaves. He would drink as often as he could afford it, and his temper and presence grew all the more oppressive with the help of alcohol. He mocked the spiritual devotion, especially in his own children and in Margaret, and openly embraced socialism and atheism, having little tolerance for the slightest of morality that his wife tried to instill in their children. Her mother did both Margaret's baptism and confirmation in secret from her father because of this. And she would, for a time, show some zeal for spiritual things, Margaret would, but eventually her father's cynicism took its toll. And after her mother's passing and being left vulnerable to her father's undermining, which eventually left Margaret bitter, lonely, and grief-stricken, she developed a bitter hatred for the church that would forever mark her life afterwards. And that becomes important later on. She eventually fled her hometown to get away via Claverack College, where she had her first taste of freedom, plunging into radical politics, feminism, and unfettered sex. She soon fell behind, though, in her academics. As it often happens, Margaret became most like the person that she was most bitter against and ended up emulating her father's erratic personality. And after dropping out because she could no longer afford tuition, she moved in with her sister and took a job as a kindergarten teacher. A youth corrupted became a youth corrupter. But thankfully, she quit after just two short terms. Now next, she applied for a job as a nurse practitioner, but the hospital work proved to be even harder than teaching for her, and she never actually finished her training. However, she would later claim to be a trained and practiced nurse, which was a flat-out lie. Her actual exposure to medicine was basically non-existent. She ran errands, changed sheets, and emptied bedpans. These details, though, haven't prevented her supporters to herald her as a qualified quote-unquote nurse to bolster her expertise. Again, a lie. Her first husband was William Sanger, who was a financially secure and up-and-coming architect. He met Margaret at a party and was smitten by her girlish redhead beauty looks, right? And he promised his devotion to her and leisure and a beautiful home and lavished her with flowers and candy and jewelry and much more. And they eventually married, but Margaret quickly became discontented with housekeeping life. Her doting husband would try everything to resolve her restlessness, sending her for long vacations, hiring maids, buying expensive presents, and building an extravagant home in Long Island. But it was all to no avail. Nothing seemed to satisfy his temperamental little bride, right? And Margaret thought that having children, perhaps, would help bring fulfillment, and they soon had two boys and a girl. But it turns out that raising children is not a hobby that is appropriate for a discontented woman who is already discontent and unhappy with life. And after 10 years of dissatisfaction with this domestic life, she convinced her husband to sell their estate and to move to Manhattan, where she could throw herself into a cosmopolitan life, shopping, dining, going to the theater, and drowning her discontent in the champagne of improvidence. Now, let's talk a little bit about the next stage of her life, which is her Marxist radicalization. While his wife was, getting herself lost in the city life, William renewed his old ties to radical politics, and he had started attending socialist and anarchist and communist meetings. Margaret would sometimes tag along with him, but didn't really show much interest at the time. Margaret ended up becoming wowed by John Reed, who was a propagandist for the Bolsheviks in Soviet Russia, who was a passionate and charismatic speaker who talked about idealistic visions of overturning the privileged status quo. This appealed to Margaret's romantic extremism, and the ideas and ideals of Marxism now came alive to her. Before long, it was all that she could think of, and she became radicalized. She read Marxist literature voraciously, and the Sanger's apartment soon became a social hub for various revolutionaries to gather. She would later write this, quote, "Our living room became a gathering place where liberals, anarchists, socialists, and IWWs could meet. These vehement individualists had to have an audience, preferably a small, intimate one. Any evening, you might find visitors being aroused by Jack Reed, bullied by Bill Hayward, or left softly towards anarchism by Alex Berkman." Her transformation was no less than equal to becoming a religious zealot. Her every waking moment was dominated by her thoughts of ushering in a great utopia by any means necessary, and her born-again left-wing fundamentalism saw violence and sabotage and assassination and subversion, insurrection and terror as mere tools towards utopia. Her radical conversion actually proved to be true, as the rest of her life was subordinated to this cause. Now, at first, her husband was pleased that his wife had a newfound purpose in life. However, she was now obsessed with conspiracies, rallying people against authorities, hatching plots, and becoming more attached to radicals. Some described her as a sycophant courtier, an omnipresent whirlwind of energy and starry-eyed adulation. She joined the Socialist Party and volunteered as a women's union organizer, speaking at labor meetings and writing editorials for the party newspaper. Margaret became impressed with the Socialist Party on women's issues and how they fought for women's suffrage and sexual liberation, feminism, and birth control. These issues became an obsession for her. They made her commitment to ushering in a socialist revolution, regardless of the material or human cost necessary, all the more urgent. She became enamored with the Red Queen of Anarchy, Emma Goldman, who championed free love, incendiary violence, birth control, and assassination, and rallied against the evils of capitalism and democracy. Sanger devoured Goldman's message through her speeches and library of radical books, such as Havelock Ellis's 7-volume Studies in the Psychology of Sex, which stirred her lust for lust. And through Goldman, Sanger was further radicalized by the works of Ibsen, Tolstoy, Voltaire, and Kropotkin, right? all of these authors who taught her grassroots mobilization tactics of the revolutionary cabals and desensitizing her to the most extreme and perverse sorts of ideas. Eventually, Margaret told her bewildered husband that she needed emancipation from every taint of Christianized capitalism, including the strict bonds of the marriage bed. She even suggested to him that they seriously considered experimenting with various trysts and infidelities and fornications and adulteries. He tried desperately to save their marriage, but to no avail. After her sexual awakening, Margaret's chief topic of discussion was always sex. She enjoyed fellowship with the avant-garde intellectuals who were practicing free love, taking mistresses and hopping from bed to bed. Margaret became an evangelist for sexual freedom and birth control. For her, the success of the social revolution was built upon the sexual revolution. The cause had to first prevail interpersonally through the carnal passions before it would prevail more widely culturally. And she reasoned that if the workers of the world were to unite, then the antiquated morals that suppressed their true innermost feelings and inhibited their true heartfelt expressions had to be eliminated. Her husband soon saw that the socialist revolution was nothing more than an excuse for sexual abandon. He tried one last time to save their marriage by moving to Paris, hoping that the romantic city would reignite their love. However, this backfired on him, as the lure of revolutionary promiscuity beckoned her. And she would eventually leave William and return to New York with her children as he bid good riddance to her. Now, let's talk a little bit about her Malthusian radicalization. Now, without a husband to finance her escapades, she had to find a way to provide income for herself and her children. So she started a paper called The Woman Rebel with the slogan, "No Gods and No Masters." And now that tells you a lot, which was it was meant as a paper of militant thought. Her first issue denounced marriage as, quote, a degenerate institution, and it took aim at capitalism and sexual modesty for good measure as well. The next issue told rebel women to, quote, look the whole world in the face with a go to hell look in your eyes, and that they should claim to be the right to be lazy, to be unmarried as a mother, and to destroy and the right to love, right? Now, later issues wrote about contraception, sexual liberation, social revolution, and defended political assassination. Her writing eventually landed her with charges of publishing lewd and indecent articles. And in order to escape the consequences, she fled the country with connections in Canada and in England. But before she fled, she published and distributed 100,000 copies of a leaflet on contraception where she recommended Lysol douches, bichloride mercury elixirs, and heavy doses of laxatives and herbal abortifacients. And she would spend over a year in England as a fugitive, where she became influenced by Thomas Malthus, a professor of political economics, who believed that overpopulation would eventually threaten the existence of humanity and that it had to be addressed by any means necessary. Really important influence on Margaret's life. In fact, Malthus argued this way, that to deal with sickness, crime, privation, and need in any other way simply aggravates the problems further. And thus he actually condemns charity and philanthropy and international relief and development and missionary outreaches and economic investment around the world as counterproductive, right? Malthus wrote in his magnum opus, an essay on the principle of population, this, quote, all children born beyond that, beyond what would be required to keep up the population to a desired level must necessarily perish, unless room be made for them by the deaths of grown persons. Therefore, we should facilitate, instead of foolishly and vainly endeavoring to impede the operations of nature in producing this mortality. And if we dread the too frequent visitation of the horrid form of famine, we should sedulously encourage the other forms of destruction which we compel nature to use. Instead of recommending cleanliness to the poor, we should encourage contrary habits. In our towns, we should make the street narrower, crowd more people into houses, and court the return of the plague. In the country, we should build our villages near stagnant pools, and particularly encourage settlements in all marshy and unwholesome situations. But above all, we should reprobate specific remedies for ravaging diseases, and restrain those benevolent, but much mistaken men who have thought that they were doing a service to mankind by projecting schemes for the total extirpation of particular disorders. Wow. So that was the kind of guy Malthus was. Now, this sounds eerily familiar. Why is that? Well, that's because Malthus still lives in many of our global elites and in WEF members who believe in this eugenics agenda. Malthus believed that the physically unfit, the poor, the diseased, the radically inferior, and mentally incompetent had to be suppressed, isolated, or eliminated in order to preserve Western civilization. Thus, his disciples thought that using education, contraception, sterilization, and abortion would be practical and acceptable ways to achieve this goal. Now, never mind that both experience, data, time, and science have disproven basically every single aspect of Malthusian analysis, this doesn't stop many progressives today and cultural elites who continue to embrace his nonsense. Now, Margaret Sanger was shrewd enough to realize that her ideas of radical socialism and sexual liberation would not be widely embraced without some veneer of altruism and intellectualism to capture the moral and academic high ground. Malthusian ethics, she thought, could help towards that end by arguing for birth control on the backdrop of the threat of poverty, sickness, racial tension, and overpopulation. Many today do not know the roots of the birth control movement. It was born in an atheistic, socialistic, Marxist, and Malthusian worldview that was opposed to a biblical worldview where our benevolent God has commanded humanity to fill the earth. Yet evangelical publications like Christianity Today publish articles praising Margaret Sanger, saying that contraception saves lives. What ridiculous drivel. Sanger now, she became a committed eugenicist. George Grant notes this of the eugenics movement. He says, quote, "In fact, for the rest of the 20th century, they would unleash one plague after another, a whole plethora of designer disasters upon the unsuspecting human race. The eugenicists unashamedly espoused an elitist white supremacy. Or to be more precise, they espoused an elitist Northern and Western European white supremacy. It was not a supremacy based on the crass ethnic racism of the past, but upon a new kind of scientific elitism deemed necessary to preserve the best of the human race in the face of impending doom," end quote. G.K. Chesterton, he once noted that if Darwinism was the doctrine of survival of the fittest, then eugenics was the doctrine of the survival of the nastiest. And in her book, Woman and the New Race, Margaret Sanger asserted that, quote, "The most merciful thing a large family can do to one of its infant members is to kill it." Let's talk about her racist eugenics. Now, freed from the marital fidelity that she was previously hindered with, Sanger's bed became a meeting place for the elite leftist radicals like H.G. Wells and George Bernard Shaw and Argot Bennett and Albernoth Lane and Northman Hare. Right? Due to her nymphomaniacal passion for promiscuity and perversion, she eventually returned to the U.S. and got the charges against her dropped through clever PR strategies, and she quickly opened a back-alley birth control clinic in Brownsville, New York, to target immigrants whom she thought were unfit, such as Slavs, Latinos, Italians, and Jews. That ended up with her being sentenced to 30 days in a workhouse, after which she started the Birth Control League, publishing the magazine Birth Control Review, which would eventually become the beginnings of Planned Parenthood. Now, the Birth Control Review regularly published racist articles. For example, in April of 1932, it outlined Margaret's plan for peace, which called for the coercive sterilization, mandatory segregation, and rehabilitative concentration camps for all dysgenic stocks. In April of 1933, it published a shocking article entitled Eugenic Sterilization, an Urgent Need, written by Ernest Rudin, Hitler's director for genetic sterilization, who took a prominent role in the establishment of the Nazi Society for Racial Hygiene. In June of 1993, an article by Leon Whitney entitled Selective Sterilization praised and defended the Third Reich's pre-Holocaust race purification programs. Now, her relationships with influential authors like H.G. Wells and Julian Huxley, Carl Menninger, and Havelock Ellis helped her garner some much-needed public support. She also wrote books herself, like The Pivot of Civilization, which called for the elimination of human weeds, The End of Charity, and The Segregation of Morons, Misfits, and the Maladjusted, and for the sterilization of genetically inferior races. Now, she criticized charity. She was against charity. And she wrote this, quote, "My criticism, therefore, is not directed at the failure of philanthropy, but rather at its success. These dangers are inherent in the very idea of humanitarianism and altruism, dangers which have today produced their full harvest of human waste." This is the type of lady Margaret Sanger was. And she goes on, quote, "The most serious charge that can be brought against the modern benevolence is that it encourages the perpetuation of defectives, delinquents, and dependents. These are the most dangerous elements in the world community, the most devastating curse on human progress and expression. Philanthropy is a gesture characteristic of modern business, lavishing upon the unfit the profits extorted from the community at large. Looked at impartially, this compensatory generosity is in its final effect probably more dangerous, more dysgenic, more blighting than the initial practice of profiteering." So she viewed charity to the poor and minorities as a, quote, "symptom of a malignant social disease, because it helped multiply, quote, those defectives, delinquents, and dependents." So she obviously abhorred these people, and she yearned for the end of the Christian reign of benevolence that they, so that the eugenic socialists promised that, when the choking human undergrowth of morons and imbeciles would be segregated and ultimately sterilized, that would bring true hope for humanity in her eyes. She wanted to create a race of thoroughbreds by encouraging these those considered fit to have children and those who were considered not fit to not have children, either willingly or through the tyranny of her Malthusian eugenics program. She intentionally set up clinics in the communities of races that she hated, such as blacks and Hispanics. She designed a, quote, "Negro project," in which she said, quote, "The masses of Negroes, particularly in the South, still breed carelessly and disastrously, with the result that the increase among Negroes, even more than among whites, is from that portion of the population least intelligent and fit." Hey friends, I just wanted to take a quick moment to ask for your support. If you've benefited from the ministry of Theotivity, please prayerfully consider partnering with me by giving a donation of any amount. Big or small, it all helps. I want to keep Theotivity going and to find ways to make it financially self-sufficient. I'd also like to be able to invest in advertising and upgrades to improve the quality of the content, all of which require money. To date, I've paid for everything out of pocket. However, with a young family, we recently adopted a little baby boy, and other commitments, this is not something I can reasonably continue to do without your help. When I started Theotivity, I had no clue if or how God would use it. It was an experiment in stepping out in faith to build something for the sake of the kingdom. I'm happy to announce that God has used it in surprising ways, with the site receiving at least 2,000 to 3,000 visits consistently per month, and a podcast steadily growing in listenership. I'm genuinely humbled and give glory to God. If you're like me, I know you long to see more solid Christian content getting out there, but that takes time, effort, and money. So, if this is something that you'd like to see continue, and if you found value in the content here at Theotivity, skip a few fancy latte drinks from your favorite woke coffee shop, and please consider donating at theotivity.com/donate. You can find links to donate in the description of this post or episode. Thanks so much. Now, back to the episode. Planned Parenthood did not begin to offer abortions until 1970, when New York legalized abortion. Now, they are the leading abortion providers in the U.S. today. And in many ways, eugenicists of 100 years ago would be proud of their work today, as their clinics are located disproportionately in poor Black and Hispanic neighborhoods. And that is on purpose. In some sections of New York, there are more Black aborted babies than live births. Quote, according to a report in the New York City Department of Health and Mental Hygiene, you can see that at cnsnews.com, in 2012, there were more Black babies killed by abortion, right, 31,328 in New York City than were born, which was only 24,758. And the Black children killed comprised 42.4% of the city's total number of abortions. On average, 1,876 black babies are aborted every day in the U.S. The abortion industry, like its founder, Margaret Sanger, is racist against black people. Yet many black people are duped into supporting liberal and democratic policies that support abortion and feign care for them, but really lead to more death and depression for them. Sanger was a sly woman. She knew that if her agenda was going to be successful, that she would have to make use of religion as well, even though she hated it. And like a good Marxist, and what many such, you know, demonic ideologies have done, she sought to co-opt the church and dupe gullible religious ministers to help accomplish her cause. Sanger wrote this, quote, "The most successful educational approach to the Negro is through a religious appeal. We do not want word to go out that we want to exterminate the Negro population. And the minister is the man who can straighten out that idea if it ever occurs to any of their most rebellious members." In her first newspaper, The Woman Rebel, Margaret Sanger admitted, quote, "Birth control appeals to the advanced radical because it is calculated to undermine the authority of the Christian churches. I look forward to seeing humanity free someday of the tyranny of Christianity, no less than capitalism." You see, the reason why Planned Parenthood targets black and minority neighborhoods are not virtuous at all. They hate black people. They focused initially on the southern states simply because of the higher population of blacks there, and then later expanded to the north and the west. And one of her own project directors lamented this, quote, "I wonder if southern darkies can ever be entrusted with a clinic. Our experience causes us to doubt their ability to work except under white supervision." The whole thing was an evil ruse to manipulate black people to cooperate in their own elimination. Their clinics were soon distributing contraceptives throughout the South to blacks, and Margaret's dream of discouraging the reproduction of what she considered to be defective and diseased elements of humanity was being fulfilled. Margaret Sanger said this, quote, "The government of the United States deliberately encourages and even makes necessary by its laws the breeding with a breakneck rapidity of idiots, defectives, diseased, feeble-minded, and criminal classes. Billions of dollars are expended by our state and federal governments and by private charities and philanthropies for the care, the maintenance, and the perpetuation of these classes. Year by year, their numbers are mounting. Year by year, more money is expended to maintain an increasing race of morons which threaten the very foundations of our civilization." Wow. That's the founder of Planned Parenthood. And she had some ideas that inspired even dictators. Let's talk about that. Sanger helped to organize a neo-Malthusian convention of dozens of representatives from around the world, composed of members of the International Federation of Neo-Malthusian Leagues and leaders in the International Eugenics Society. And they delivered papers and speeches and workshops promoting their vision of eugenics. This group was composed of radical proponents of racial hygiene societies and birth control leagues and family planning associations and social eugenics committees. They were self-consciously anti-Christian, anti-family, and anti-choice from the start. And they were also the beginnings of what now has now come to be known as Planned Parenthood, which rebranded after World War II. They were lobbying for national organizations to consider the necessity of limiting freedom of choice through legal and economic reproductive incentives and disincentives such as a child tax, reduction or elimination of maternity leave, and limiting access to loans, scholarships, and more for families with more than the approved number of children. Planned Parenthood even later publicly commended the brutal one-child policy of the Communist Chinese Party. Planned Parenthood was even willing to sidestep the law. For example, in the Philippines, where abortion was illegal at that time, they offered menstrual extractions, quote unquote. And in Brazil, where sterilization was illegal, they performed as many as 20 million procedures per year. According to internal directives from their London office of Planned Parenthood, they said, quote, "Family planning associations and other non-government organizations should not use the absence of the law or the existence of an unfavorable law as an excuse for inaction. Action outside the law and even in violation of it is part of the process of stimulating change." Adolf Hitler himself adopted Sanger's neo-Malthusian ideas in his administration of the Third Reich for his extermination program, The Final Solution, which included coercive abortion programs throughout Poland, Yugoslavia, and Czechoslovakia. He echoed the Malthusian call to rid the earth of dysgenic peoples by whatever means available so that we may enjoy the prosperity of the fatherland. And he reiterated the Planned Parenthood ideal of the elimination of all Christian mercy ministries or social service programs. In 1939, Hitler said, quote, "Let us spend our efforts and our resources on the productive, not on the wastrel." Joseph Stalin also used Planned Parenthood's neo-Malthusian ideas in his brutal campaign against Ukraine, his collectivization of the kulaks, and his Siberian genocide. Stalin stated this, quote, "The greatest obstacle to the successful completion of the People's Revolution is a swarming of inferior races from the South and East, and that the only thing preventing him was the, quote, foolhardy interference of church charity." Now, let's talk a little bit about Sanger in her later years and how she reaped what she sowed. Even though Sanger had become very successful at what she set out to achieve, She was miserable on the inside. And as Proverbs 14:1 says, "Every wise woman builds her house, but a foolish woman tears it down with her own hands." And that was true of Sanger. Margaret had destroyed her marriage. Her daughter died during one of her long absences from pneumonia, and her boys were neglected constantly, and her beauty was becoming faded with the years of abuse. Yet even with this, she pursued more perversion and more sexual promiscuity, jumping from lover to lover and experimenting with increasingly more perverse fetishes and fantasies. And this is usually how sexual sin goes. It never satisfies, but only leads to deeper and more depraved forms of degeneracy. She even dove into the occult and New Age, looking for meaning there. Even as an old woman, she was constant in her corrupting of the youth. She told her 16-year-old granddaughter that kissing, petting, and even intercourse were fine as long as they were sincere, and that having sex about 3 times a day was just about right. Planned Parenthood today continues to seek to corrupt the sexual morals of youth in virtually all of his literature, teaching kids to masturbate and endorsing premarital sex, approving homosexuality and everything LGBTQ+, and encouraging sexual experimentation and vilifying Christian values and consciences as outdated, prude, and oppressive. Now, eventually, Margaret would marry into money again, marrying an oil millionaire, J. Noah Slee, but not before forcing him to sign a prenuptial, which stipulated that she could come and go as she pleased with no questions and have her own private apartment and servants where she could entertain her quote-unquote friends behind closed doors. And Slee would have to phone her in advance if he wanted a date with his own wife. That sounds like a really great start to that marriage. She continued her promiscuous affairs even into old age, and her health declined as she became addicted to drugs and alcohol. Sanger continued to rub shoulders and other body parts with the social elites of her day to promote her causes. As a woman possessed, she had as her supporters people like Julian Huxley, Albert Einstein, and John D. Rockefeller, and even the Emperor, the Japanese Emperor Hirohito, and Henry Ford, and even the presidents like Harry Truman and Dwight Eisenhower. And now, although she was terribly unhappy, she was now also terribly rich too, because she married a millionaire. And these newly acquired financial resources allowed her to open doors, exercise sway on public campaigns, and to have opportunities previously inaccessible to her. She became closely associated with the Nazi race purification program and endorsed the euthanasia, sterilization, abortion, and infanticide programs that the Third Reich was promoting. She would later backpedal her positions, though, when the Nazi programs came to light after World War II, and she tried to cover it up. The name Planned Parenthood was chosen to help redeem her public image, as it connoted a positive program, which was family-oriented. This helped to divert attention from its revolutionary eugenics aims by focusing attention on birth control. She managed to garner tremendous financial support through her tenacious search for donors and grants. But as George Grant notes, quote, "From its earliest days, Planned Parenthood movement has been involved in financial scandal. Despite the fact that she received generous donations from some of the richest philanthropies in the world, Margaret kept her organization on the brink of bankruptcy for years, failing to pay her bills and refusing to give an account for her mismanagement. She would often spend Planned Parenthood's money on her own extravagant lifestyle and invested its funds in the black market. She wasted money on many frivolities and vanities, and because of this, she was quietly removed, actually, from Planned Parenthood's board several times. Proverbs 1:8-9 teaches us that violence and greed are inseparable, and Planned Parenthood's wicked violence against women and children cannot be separated from its roots of material greed, and even from its founder's greed. A seed will always yield its fruit of its own kind. You know, you can see Genesis 1:11, for example, right? That's just the way God has created this world. And bad seed brings forth a bitter harvest. And you can see Ezra 9:2 and Isaiah 1:4 and 14:20 for examples of that. Right? You reap what you sow, as Galatians 6:7 says. A nation or an organization that is sown and nurtured and grown by deceit, promiscuity, and lawlessness cannot help but be evil to the core, as it says in Hosea 8:9. And Planned Parenthood has not changed since then, because its roots still remains wicked. Dr. Alan Guttmacher, who is Margaret Sanger's successor as the president of Planned Parenthood, he proudly said this, quote, "We are merely walking down the path that Mrs. Sanger carved out for us." And Faye Wattleson, the organization's president in the 1980s, she said that she was, quote, "proud to be walking in the footsteps of Margaret Sanger." And indeed, they do continue on that path even to today. And the same is true in Canada and in other nations where abortion is legalized and continues to go on a grand scale, right? That these corruptions within Planned Parenthood and their embezzlement of funds and all these other things, you can't expect that those who run organizations dedicated to the murder of the most innocent in society to somehow magically be ethical in other areas of their business dealings. Stories of body parts of aborted babies being sold for profit, or killing babies born alive in botched abortions, and embezzlement of funds which are gained tax-free because these organizations are non-profits, this shouldn't surprise us. A bad tree brings forth bad fruit, and it must be cut down and rooted out to never spring up again. This is our battle. Every generation of Christians has its battles to fight against the dragon. Just when you think the beast's head has been fatally wounded, it arises again to torment the saints. And this would not be the first time in history that Christians have had to rise up to defend the rights of unborn and of babies. Abortion, infanticide, and abandonment to the elements was common in the practice of Roman society in the first centuries. A Greco-Roman culture had little regard for the weak and helpless, and children were seen as disposable, particularly by a father who deemed the offspring undesirable. Charles Eldridge, in his book, Christianity's Contribution to Civilization, notes this, quote, "Occasionally, benevolent persons might rescue such children. Sometimes witches would take them and use their bodies for incantations. Some of them died from exposure, while the majority were taken and reared by lewd persons and finally sold as slaves or prostitutes." Now, one of the early charges against the early Christians, like the apologist Justin Martyr had to deal with, was that they were cannibals. That's really interesting. And this was because they would be seen picking up the children who were abandoned or thrown out into the dumps. And pagans looking on and hearing about the Christians' love feasts, where they ate the flesh and drank the blood, right? Talking about communion, these pagans assumed that they were devouring the infants, when they were really adopting them into their families and raising them as their own, at their own expense as well. And as Christianity expanded in the Roman Empire, so did their pro-life work. We need to regain this again as the church today, with many more Christians being willing to adopt and foster and to provide homes for abandoned children and to provide an alternative for mothers who can't care for their child, right? We must also be bold about doing this work founded on the gospel proclamation. It must be a distinctly Christian work. And why? Because although there are all these great, you know, secular arguments against abortion, because the science today is undeniable, as Nancy Piercy has noted, virtually no professional bioethicist today denies that life begins at conception. But, you know, only Christians can offer true forgiveness and hope for mothers who have murdered their children, or fathers who have pushed their women to do so. Sinners need to be called to repentance and given the offer of true hope. And the secular pro-life movement can't do this. Let me continue from a quote from Eldridge. He says this, quote, "The church councils, Christian emperors, and lawmakers sought by declarations and legislation to combat the crime of," this is of infanticide and abortion in the early centuries. As early as 323 in the Council of Nice, decreed that hospitals should be established in the chief cities and towns and exhorted that these hospitals should make provision to care for abandoned children. Houses of mercy were provided by the church for these foundlings. A marble vessel was placed at each church to receive exposed infants. These children were sometimes adopted by members. Those not cared for by some private family were taken under the charge of the church. Now, that we would regain this Christian heritage and once again slay the beast of abortion. We are to be the salt and light, to preserve and illuminate a decaying and dark world by seeking the kingdom's establishment and expansion here. And we've gotten to where we are today because Christians have checked out of public engagement for far too long, thinking that their pietistic holy huddles were somehow a virtuous strategy. But meanwhile, the Lord had already said that no one with any common sense hides a lamp under a basket. Now, just recently, I was made aware by a Canadian MP that through an email that the topic of euthanasia for babies was brought up in the Canadian Parliament. Do you believe that? Dr. Louis Roy, and I've got links for this in the article, of the Quebec College of Physicians recommended expanding euthanasia, quote, to babies from birth to 1 year of age, who come into the world with severe deformities and very serious syndromes. Now let's be clear, right? What's happening here? This doctor is advocating for straight up infanticide to be legal in Canada. Now let that sink in. That's where this culture of death is going if Christians continue to stay silent. We're going to, and we are currently inheriting the Margaret Sanger's dystopian vision of the future where life is not valued anymore and those with power can deem certain lives expendable. That's what's happening. And that's why this history is important for you to understand, because this is the trajectory that it has put us on. God requires that we pursue justice for the unborn. In scripture, one of the reasons that God rejects his people's prayers and worship services is because of their neglect of justice. In Isaiah 1 verses 13 to 17, God says this. He says, "Bring no more vain offerings. Incense is an abomination to me. New moon and Sabbath and the calling of convocations, I cannot endure iniquity and solemn assembly. Your new moons and your appointed feasts, my soul hates. They have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing them. When you spread out your hands, I will hide my eyes from you. Even though you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Wash yourselves, make yourselves clean. Remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes. Cease to do evil, learn to do good. Seek justice, correct oppression, and bring justice to the fatherless. Plead the widow's cause." Now, could it be that one of the reasons the church today has been so powerless and its prayers unanswered is because of his neglect of true justice for the fatherless? And this is exactly who the target group of abortions are, the fatherless. Yet this neglect of what is what God threatens his judgment for in Malachi 3:5. You could go read that later. And he commands that we do no violence to the fatherless, nor shed innocent blood in Jeremiah 22:3. And there has been much of that, exactly that, happening in modern societies today. And I think it is part of the reason for the weakness of the church here, where we have the means and the ability to do something about it without even risking our lives today, but we're too lazy, ignorant, or apathetic about it. After we adopted our son, just recently my wife and I adopted, this whole issue got a whole lot more personal as I look into his beautiful face every day and think that this is what some people want the right to murder and dismember. Wickedness. Like the sort that we should rend our clothes and pour ash on our heads over. You know, many Christians today think that they would have been part of the movement of evangelicals who lobbied to bring an end to the evils of slavery in England and eventually the Western world. However, then, as now, there were many Christians who knew about the issues, but they stood on the sidelines, thinking things would never change, that the culture was too far gone, and slavery was an accepted norm, right? They didn't approve of slavery personally, but they sat back, not wanting to cause any trouble. If we don't raise a godly ruckus for the horrible evil of our day in abortion, What makes you think that you would have, been with the abolitionists during slavery? The point of this episode is not just to give you some information. What I'm praying for is that it would help to stir up the next generation of pro-life, gospel-centered warriors who will storm hell's gates because they're guaranteed by our Lord that hell's gates won't prevail. And maybe said of us, what was said of Jason and the disciples in Acts 17, that they were men who turned the world upside down and acted against the decrees of Caesar, saying that there's another king, Jesus. And that this is not some social justice, social gospel sort of thing that I'm talking about here, okay? We must do this self-consciously and consistently as biblical Christians, not laying down our Christian worldview to make supposedly neutral arguments, appealing only to things like natural law. No, we have a clear word from the King of Kings, and it is upon that infallible and authoritative word that we take our marching orders to tear down strongholds, arguments, and every lofty opinion against Christ and bring every thought captive to Him. And we must not stop until abortion is aborted. It must be abolished, and legal protections must be put into place for life from womb to tomb. Incremental laws may have some help in reducing abortions, you know, such as heartbeat bills and so on, but they're not enough, nor are they even consistent with a biblical view on this issue. Right? Think about it. How ridiculous is it that we legislate to simply reduce murders? You know, like, oh, could you just maybe murder a little bit less, or maybe not beyond this age, right? Ridiculous. Too much of the pro-life movement has settled for just mere pragmatism, which only incrementally seeks harm reduction instead of annihilating the threat altogether. Now, some incrementalist laws even tend to make the situation worse by simply legislating Planned Parenthood and other abortion providers' competition out of business. That's details for another time. Aside from the barbaric dismemberment of abortions, right, there also exist chemical abortions and home abortions, which must be dealt with. And these sorts of incremental laws don't even address that. Right? Now, obviously, I'm for abolition. I think that should be our final goal. I'm not necessarily against incremental steps. Like, I would not oppose a bill that reduces the amount of abortions that happens, but that's not my end goal. And that should not be our end goal. This is a battle that's going to be extensive. And like any good war strategy to win, victory must be comprehensive to ensure that the enemy does not rise up and regroup and come back again. Right? So let me end off this episode with some tangible, practical next steps and places that you can go for more information and action that you can take. Okay. So firstly, check out choice42.com. That's choice for the number two, right? Like the numbers 4 and 2.com. It's a consistently Christian pro-life organization run by Laura Klassen, who used to work in the film industry, actually. And they've put out some really amazing animated info videos and provide resources and encouragement for moms to choose life and not to murder their babies. You can check out in Canada, weneedalaw.ca. And this is a ministry arm of ARPA Canada, right, I believe, that works on the end of advocacy and petitioning civil government. Right? Maybe contact them. Offer to volunteer your time. Donate. Write MPs and rally your church together. ARPA and We Need a Law often has different campaigns that they do throughout the year where you write MPs or you try to petition for change to happen. Because right now in Canada, there are no laws that limit abortion. You can also check out the Canadian Center for Bioethical Reform, which is another pro-life group in Canada that works in public education around the dark truth of abortion and helping people see it for what it actually is. Really important work there, because a lot of ignorance exists in the public on this. Lastly, you can also check out your local pregnancy care center and see how you can volunteer and donate and get trained to help out. Not all pregnancy care centers are the same. Some, I think, operate on a less than biblical worldview, but as far as you can, to partner with ones that are consistently Christian and biblical on this issue, do so, because it's needed. Let's not sit back, right? Let's not sit back on our couches and not do anything, right? We have to go forward. We must seek justice for the fatherless, because we're children of the Father who has adopted us into His family. So I hope that's encouraged you. and give you some practical kind of next steps and good information, maybe to share with your friends and so on. If you enjoyed this episode or it was enlightening to you, or you know somebody who maybe needs to hear this, please share it around, spread the word, right? We need to think well on these issues. And I look forward to the day, perhaps maybe not in my lifetime, but it'd be a great thing to see when abortion is aborted and is no longer a scourge in our societies. Until next time, soli Deo Gloria. Thanks for listening to the Theotivity Podcast. If you found this content helpful or edifying, please leave a review on Apple, Google, Spotify, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. Also, follow us on social media and consider sharing this episode to help Theotivity reach others as well. Check out theotivity.com for resources, info on how to support, and subscribe to our monthly newsletter to stay up to date on all the latest content. Until next time, live and create to the glory of God.